Mortal Kombat. I'm fast like the gingerbread man. They can't catch me. They're men and they're stronger, but I cannot run them. I'm running down my stairwell, through the corridor, out onto the wintry street. In the next scene, they send a woman. She asks for it, and I give it to her. She feels all my anger at being persecuted in my own home. I don't run. I fight her on the floor of my bathroom. I have her in a chokehold, and I'm bashing her head in, over and over again on the tile. Her face is rigid with shock, and it's this expression of defeat that makes my rage more powerful than my fear. In the final sequence, the men watch me run down the stairwell. They let me go. They know, and I do too, that this time there's something waiting to receive me in the lobby. It's my boss. He's wearing a woman's wig and a dress, and he falls backward as I throw the door open. So long, sucker. I feel the cold. I'm outside, and I wonder if my feet are bare. That's when the man thrusts a knife into my throat. I know I'm awake. The dream is finished, and all I have to do is be still and know that I am God. Violence was a regular feature of my nightscape when I was in the safe zone. Living in Holland, cycling home at 2 a.m., with the certainty that no one would ever accost me. I cycled past men on foot, men on bikes, and they didn't throw up something dirty with their eyes, their mouths, or their bodies. And yet the dreams are the worst in Holland. They were frequent enough for me to figure out that they preceded the first spotting of my menstrual flow. I was attacked, but I was also really good at violence. It was a Mortal Kombat type of scenario. Flesh, hair, innards, and limbs flying, filling the screen. I checked the period tracker light app on my phone, and it says I'm not premenstrual. I have no excuse for this dream. I'm still scared of New York. But sometimes I disarm and put myself out there. I play the hero, even though I'm not brave. I'm this close to getting home and out of the blizzard when I see a granny standing in the middle of the road. I walk onto the road and say, "You need to get off the road." She whimpers, "The ice, the ice." It's obvious she needs to be grabbed, but I can't tell if she's scared of black people and if she'll resist or hurt me if I grab her. I wait at the side of the road, but the white driver and pedestrians pretend not to see her. It turns out she's used to strangers rescuing her, and is very compliant. She lets me pull her onto the sidewalk. "I'm taking you to my building. Can I call your family?" She's quite hopeless, not drunk or mentally ill, but something is missing. She gives me a telephone number that's short 4 digits. She begins to cry, "No, I don't want to go to your house." I believe she really understands, so I ignore the impulse to push and pull her like a sheep towards my lobby. "I'm calling the police. Can I call the police?" I ask her. "Yes," she says urgently, "call the police." I'm kind of disappointed in 911. They're different in real life. Slow and lots of questions. What's her name? What color's her hat? How old is she? I look at her face pressed against my coat, and I answer, "She's a senior, maybe in her 60s? And then I ask her, "Betsy, how old are you?" She answers, "I'm 42. Huh. She's not a disoriented geriatric, but something is wrong with her. I don't want to say it, though. "Betsy, do you have a mental problem?" I ask. "I don't know." So I say to 911, "She has Down syndrome." And then she says it herself. "I have Down syndrome." They want to know my full name. They make me spell it. And then, "Are you going to stay with her?" I have aubergine, tomatoes, spring onion, and peppers in my shopping bag. And I want to Google an easy ratatouille recipe tonight. Mummy makes the best ratatouille. And I want to be in my kitchen, thinking of Mommy tossing salt over the thick slices of aubergine. But I'm on the road, playing the hero. "Yes, okay," I snap at 911. "I won't leave her." We wait forever, and then the police come. And as they exit the car, they're already cooing. "Come on, Betsy. We're going to get you home now, Betsy." They know her. She knows the drill and lets them cajole her into the police car. I want the police to thank me, but they don't. This is the first time I've ever really been offended by the police. I grew up with hungry cops. Their weapons and their uniforms barely concealed their lack of power, or that they were malnourished or at least undernourished. They've come a long way. This summer they detained me in a police car parked under a tree. I was driving without a license. I've never had a license. It was cool in the police car and I lingered. They wanted to know about my life in New York. As I counted out my fine, I told the policewoman that I was very proud of her and that I should have joined the police force when I left college 20 years ago, but I lacked courage. The policeman, her supervisor, asked me if I was married, and I told him that if he wanted to marry me, he should go talk to my father. My father, the general, was waiting in the passenger seat of Mommy's car, parked in the sun across the street. The policeman chided me. "Professor, this isn't the village. And anyway, there are women's rights in Zambia too now. First I must spend some time with you, take you out, wine you, win you. And then if you want, I can talk to your father. I'm not afraid of your father." I blushed in my earlobes and underarms. Here, the cops are fat, even the muscular ones on eHarmony who pose topless with their guns. They're looking for someone beautiful inside and outside, loving, adventurous, and no bullshit or games, please, ladies, because I don't need any more of that. More or less the same type of lady the guys in finance and the lawyers are looking for. Actually, I'd like to date a policeman, but I lack courage. Rescuing Betsy has given me a head cold. It's as if I have a wet towel wrapped around my head. I sleep badly, and I'm shivering even with a hot water bottle in bed with me. I sponge bath at noon and step out carrying some overdue library books. There are kids on the bridge making a riot, throwing balls of snow over the bridge and onto the highway below. They're not black, they're not white, they're everything in between that you can imagine. I look at all of the adults walking by the kids. They're white and old enough to be afraid of adolescents, so it's on me. "Cut it out! Stop that! You guys know better than that!" They stop immediately. They're probably relieved to be stopped. They turn on the one who ignores me. He's busy making a really big ball, lifting it up carefully, cupping it right before the drop. They scream at him, "Cut it out, James! I told you, man! Nigga, stop!" He turns on me. He's the tallest of the boys, and that's enough to make you the leader. He says in a phony Spanish accent, "Me no speaky English." He's still holding the snowball. I'm incensed. "No, no, 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 that is not on. I'm calling the police now." "The police," they scream. They're taller than me, but their voices are still like girls. "Yes, you're going to hurt someone. Imagine a nervous driver gets a big ball of snow on her window and veers out of her lane and hits someone. Where's your brain?" James drops the snowball at my feet. They apologize, they call me ma'am. They disperse. Some cross the bridge towards Independence Avenue and the others toward Netherlands Avenue. There's a fire truck on Netherlands, and I tell the firemen about the snow on the bridge. I tell them someone needs to clear the snow. And they tell me someone needs to call the police and the kids, but yeah, what's the use? I have a week off work because of the president's birthdays. I don't have much hair left. It's been falling out steadily since November, and now I have a bald spot in the center of my head. In the mornings, I afro-comb my hair bent over the bathtub, wipe up all the fallen curls with the wet tissue, and flush it all down the toilet. I'm this close to going to Jerry's and letting him shave it all off. I look at the pictures of myself with a shaved head. I looked tough and soft at the same time. Pretty, but it takes attitude. I don't think I could raise that attitude again. I've fallen pretty deep for the Bronx hetero femme gender performance of beauty. So I call Khadija. She doesn't remember me, but she tells me to come down to her shop at Mount Eden. The shop has changed. The barber and the Latina woman doing hair are still there. But there's an old white Latino at an executive desk selling food supplements. And there are lads playing at a huge pool table. They call out politely enough, "Hey, mommy, hey." Khadija has a fresh new baby tied with a lapa on her back. The baby's fast asleep and her nose is dirty. Poor little thing. She's breathing like me through her mouth. Khadija still looks pregnant, and her hair is cut short like a boy. "What happened to your hair?" I ask her. "Perm. Perm breaks my hair like crazy. Now I say no more chemicals in my hair, sister." She rubs my bald spot and asks, "What happened to your hair?" I shake my head sadly. "Problems, Khadija. Hey, I have problems." This makes her laugh, but sympathetically. One of the lads calls out, "I got you some pizza, but they say you don't eat pork, Khadija." I can't see his face, so I can't tell if he's cracking a joke or if he'd really brought us some pizza. I argue with Khadija about the cheap wig she wants to use in my head and the price of the job. I leap out of the chair when she begins to separate my hair with a pick comb. I apologize and leave. It's not really about the price or the wig. It's a sick baby and the traffic of boisterous young hunks. I can't stand to be around them for 4 hours. I take the train back to 231st and Broadway and pop into Mustafa's for some shea butter. The ladies are there, and when I tell them I'm on the way to the barber at 242nd, they charm me back into the shop. And when I tell them I'm on the way to the barber at 242nd, they charm me into the back of the store where the hair salon is, and in no time, the first braid is installed. Don't worry, sister. Even this, they're up the bald spot. Even this will grow. They are a lot more expensive than Khadija, but they're not as unhappy as she is, and the 4 hours go by quickly. In the beginning, they talk about raising American kids. When my son starts school, the teacher tells him not to play with the black boys. They're bad. And he didn't listen. My husband beat him, almost to death. He said, I didn't work hard to bring you from Togo so you can ruin us. And now there's no problem, only school. My son is a good student. Later we watch videos of West African leader state visits. There's Samuel Doe, a young man with a full afro. Doe descends from a plane and is received by Flight Lieutenant Jerry Rawlings. They were so young, I say. The ladies ask me if I've seen the video. I know they mean the torture video, where Doe's ears, fingers, and toes are hacked off. No, I was just a child when it happened. And just in case they have the video, I tell them, it's a shameful, shameful thing. They agree, but then they add, Samuel Doe did the same thing to his own uncle, killed him like a dog. He didn't know God was watching. In the final hour, we talk about God. Aifata holds her smartphone in front of my face, and I see a man being interviewed. It takes me a while to understand that the massive sack in his lap is a testicle, swollen beyond belief. I close my eyes and make a sound of protest. Shh! She keeps the phone in my face anyway. She really wants me to see this. What's wrong with him? He went to Mecca, but he didn't really believe in God. That's a sin. He couldn't fool God. God saw his heart. This is God's curse on unbelievers. She puts up the volume. He says it himself. God has cursed me. She removes the screen and says with solemnity, Sister, God is great. It's not always winter. I was walking down the street feeling very beautiful and womanly in a clingy sundress, Ethiopian silver, and massive $4 sunglasses. I crossed the street by the public library, and an old white man called out from his convertible, Yeah, shake that fat ass! I was on Broadway and 239s, opposite Staples, buying veggies, and a man of indeterminate race and class walking by shouted, Slut! I looked around to see who he was talking to, but the entire street had turned to look at me. In Harlem, a man, ruined by hard living, asked me to give him a smile. I didn't smile. I'm afraid of black American men in Harlem. He screamed after me, Fuck you, you think your pussy's so hot. And that's it. That's the best the street has given me. This is it, the last dream. It starts high and happy. I'm speaking eagerly about cancer and loss and anger with a woman I met at the Sunday salon. And then I drop. This is not the flying and then falling dream. It's as if someone has pulled the bed out from under me. I land hard and I'm winded, lying like the chalk man at the murder scene. But I'm lucid and I can manage a whisper. Get up. Hide in the closet, Mama. He's here. And then, no, sister, we're not going to live like that anymore. It takes time, some hours, before I can put myself under again. Boarding school instills a certain discipline in you. This is a gift I took from institutional life. I know how to live with the dark. There's a beep. It's a WhatsApp message from Mommy to her daughters. I'm blessed. Have a blessed day, all of you.